So I'm going to talk about, indeed more specific, the ultra-short lifetime expansion we did for calculating cross-sections of resonant inelastic X-ray scattering. This work has been done with my supervisor, Jeroen, and Fiona Forte from Salerno, Italy. So let me start out by explaining what RIGS is. So basically, you shoot X-ray photons at some interesting sample, and you look at the scattered photons, and this gives you some information on the system. So it's a resonant technique. That means you tune the energy of the incoming X-rays to one of the transitions in your sample. So let's have drawn this 1S4P transition. And this creates a hole in one of the core levels of one of the atoms in your system. So you get a potential for the valence electrons that wander through your system. And by the interaction of the valence electrons with this core hole, you can transfer momentum and energy. So that's why the outgoing photon will have a different energy and momentum. So the energy of the incoming X-rays is very big, of the order of 10 kilo electron volts. So that gives you a lot of momentum to actually probe the whole Riemann zone. So after a short time, this electron fills the core state again. So you get this outgoing photon, and that's the one you observe. Why this technique? It's basically complementary to other techniques you have, like Raman scattering at much lower incident photon energy. So there's not so much momentum in there, and you cannot get any momentum dependence in your results. RIGS is able to do that. And it's also complementary to neutron scattering, because for neutrons you need, in general, big samples, and it's hard to make, and maybe not so... not so cheap, and also if you want to do pressure measurements, I guess it's nicer if you have very small samples. Another advantage is that you can tune your energy of your X-rays to any resonance in the system you want, so you can probe the excitation you're interested in many different ways. And the last point is, why not? Well, of course, the experimentalists are doing this, so for us three guys, it's nice to explain all the strange things they see. So the outline of the talk is as follows. First, I'll present the theoretical framework, so the UCL expansion, ultra-short core hole lifetime. And then I'll talk about what you can measure with RIGS. So basically, I'll talk about three things: charge excitations. The main part of the talk will be about magnetic excitations. And if we have still time, I'll talk about orbital RIGS, or orbital excitations. So for this magnetic thing, I make a distinction between indirect and direct RIGS. So indirect RIGS is where you shoot the core electron to a high energy state far above the Fermi surface. So it's indirect in the sense that your electron doesn't directly influence your valence electrons, but only because of this potential you created. You can also do direct RIGS, where you shoot your electron into the valence band. And of course, different processes play a role there. Okay, so what do you typically see in the spectra? Here's an example from Zahid Hassan. What you see is the big elastic peak. So there's a huge elastic peak with an inelastic tail, and you can see the Brillouin zone, and basically they probe at different positions, different momentum transfers. They probe the energy loss spectrum, so that are these successive spectra, and you see that, for instance, this inelastic feature here, which they associate with the Mott gap, disperses. So at different wave factors, you get different energies. Okay, so before we go to this UCL expansion, I'll first explain what happens in detail. So you have some empty state above the Fermi surface in this case, valence electrons and the core states. You excite the system with the X-rays, and this creates a core hole potential, and this moves the states, the other states, down in energy. And because these levels in the intermediate state do not necessarily have to fully overlap with the original states, there's a probability that you end up in some excited state here. And after the decay of this core hole, so the electron drops back, you do the same thing again, so the levels move up again, and again, you can end up in some excited state, as you see here. So that's how it works in detail. Well, these intermediate states are very hard to calculate, so we would like to get rid of them, and that's the idea of this ultra-short core hole lifetime. It basically gets rid of these intermediate states. Why is that so nice? In principle, you would assume that there is no small parameter in this system a priori. You're at resonance, so you heavily perturb your system, your valence electrons. But because this process is very fast, the order of femtoseconds, you do have a small parameter there to make an expansion. So that's the ultra-short core hole lifetime. Theory works as follows. We start with the Kramers-Heisenberg relation, which is basically Fermi golden rule to second order, because the intermediate states are important. The cross-section is dependent on momentum and energy loss omega. So we start with, if you look at the scattering amplitude here, we start with an initial state. O is the dipole operator, which excites you to intermediate state. And D excites it again to some excited final state. Omega detuning is this. So this is the detuning from of the energy of the incoming X-rays from resonance. So at resonance, this thing is zero. En are the energies of the intermediate states. And gamma is the lifetime broadening of these intermediate states. So that's fairly large. Right? So intermediate states. So it's of the order of one electron volt. Okay. So I'll show you how this expansion works. It's actually quite simple, so fits on one slide. So what I first do is introduce this parameter delta here, which basically takes this omega det minus I gamma together. I just take it out, nothing fancy here. And you can rewrite this to this form. And what you see here is basically the geometric series, right? 1 over 1 minus x, if this is a small number. So in order to make this work, we need to make a few assumptions. First thing we assume is that the 4p excited state, so that's where the electron ends up when you shoot it from the core state, does not interact with your valence electrons. For instance, in transition metals, where you shoot a core electron to a 4p state, you could say this is quite okay, because the 4p orbitals are fairly large if you compare them to 3d orbitals. Another thing is that the lifetime broadening of the intermediate states must be larger than the intermediate states. Of course, this is very system specific, but there are a number of things that help you here. So first of all, you could say if the intermediate state energy is very big, then from the start, you could throw them away because they give a small contribution here. You divide by a large number, and then you could leave them out from the start, so you don't see them anymore here. Also, you have to look at the overlap here of the wave functions. So if your excited initial state does not overlap with some intermediate state, you're also fine. You can just leave them out from the very beginning, and they won't show up here. And a last thing that helps you is the detuning from resonance. So if you go off resonance, then basically you increase this parameter delta I showed you here, and still this ratio becomes small, so you can do this expansion. So there's a number of things that are important here. Okay, so now I inserted this geometric series. It's just sum over L from 0 to infinity of this small parameter. And you can see now that if you do the sum over N here, you can invoke this spectral decomposition thing, and you end up with the Hamiltonian here for the excited states. So this is a Hamiltonian that acts on the valence electrons, and we modeled in there this core hole potential. Okay, so basically what we did is we traded the sum over intermediate states for a sum over L, and our hope is now that you can cut off the sum after a few terms because of the large core hole broadening, so large delta compared to this thing. See, so using this ultra-short core hole lifetime, we get rid of the intermediate states. So now we can address the question, what do we actually measure? So we take this scattering amplitude, and we put in some very general model, and in the end you'll see that this will reduce to just S of Q and omega, the dynamic structure factor of the system, of the valence electrons. So the problem with calculating this thing is that you have the intermediate state Hamiltonian to the Lth power, and this Hamiltonian is composed of the unperturbed Hamiltonian for the valence electrons, and some in general large perturbation by this core hole. And if you take the Lth power of this, these things don't commute in general, so that's hard to calculate. Okay, so we put in some very general model here. So we take arbitrary range hopping and Coulomb interactions for the valence electrons, and for the interaction, we assume the core hole to be immobile. That's a fairly good assumption because the core states are very localized and don't overlap much with other states. And the potential generated by this core hole and excited electron pair is certainly largest at the core hole site. So you could say it's locally there. So the monopole contribution will vanish at larger distances because it's still charge neutral. You still have the excited electron there. Okay, so we take the initial state to be in the ground state, and then we make some approximation for this hard to calculate intermediate state Hamiltonian to the Lth power. That's valid for both strong and weak perturbations by the core hole. Then you can show that for the scattering amplitude, you come to this expression. So you basically, for spinless fermions, probe the charge density correlation function with some resonant prefactor. So that's written here. UC is the core hole potential strength. And again, you can see that depending on the energy of the incoming X-rays, you can change the value of this resonant prefactor, because the real part of this delta is the detuning from resonance. You can do the same for fermions that do a spin, a little bit more interesting case. And what you see is that you get two contributions. So again, the charge density correlation function, but also the longitudinal spin density correlation function. So that basically measures the amplitude of the spins from side to side. And this is a higher order charge correlation. The nice thing is of this result is that you have two different resonant prefactors. So you shouldn't, this one is different from that one, by the way. But the nice thing is that you can, with the incoming energy, the energy of the incoming X-rays, you can tune either to this part or to this part of the scattering amplitude. So you can see either spins or charge. So that's a cute result. Not entirely true. So I think you can either make one very large and the other small, or you can make them both very large. But in principle, you can shift the balance of these two contributions by changing the energy of the incident X-rays. So that basically concludes the first part. So the coral couples to charges, of course, that's obvious, and you measure charge and longitudinal spin density. But question now is, can you probe other excitations? So than your usual charge ones. That's not so obvious, of course, because the coupling is electric. Well, there's some data on this high TC compound below the mod gap. So the things we calculated before are zero. You cannot end up in a charge excited final state. I'll show you the data here. So this blue line here is off resonance. These are measurements by John Hill. And if you tune the X-rays to resonance, you see an excitation here. This is at a certain wave factor. And if you remove the elastic contribution here, then you get these things. And well, what you see is that there is a peak at 500 milli-electron volts. And this is below the mod gap. So this cannot be some charge excitation.
What does off-resonance mean?
Oh, so...
that related to the detuning you were talking about?
Yes. So on-resonance is your X-ray energy corresponds to a certain transition in the system. And off-resonance means you go one electron volt below or above.
One electron volt is off-resonance?
One electron volt is off-resonance, yeah. Well, it also depends, of course, on the specific situation you look at. You also have... you can also do this thing in a low energy regime. So if you take the core level to be a 3P level, for instance, and shoot it to a 3D level, so it's not really a core state anymore, but then the energy of the incoming X-rays are like 100 EV, then maybe off resonance is a bit less. Okay, so now the question is, what are these excitations? So a few candidates come to mind. You can say phonons, maybe multiphonons, DD excitations, or magnons. Well, for phonons, this is a bit high in energy, of course, 500 MeV. Multiphonons could maybe be, but unlikely. John Hill has some argument against DD excitations. He measured also this other compound, neodymium copper oxide, which has a slightly different crystal field at the copper sites. And if this peak is a DD excitation, you would assume this thing to move if you change the crystal field, right? So it doesn't. So that's an argument against DD excitations.
What do you mean DD excitations?
So
local excitation from one.
Yeah. So the 3D level split up in this crystal field. And you could go from one 3D level to a different one. That's a little bit different in energy. Okay, so we'll go for the magnon scenario. Well, I guess you all know this. So these are the details on lithium copper oxide. It's basically this layered material of copper oxide. Only the layers are interesting.
You say GD, you're talking about the Jahn-Teller energy or something?
Well, Jan Teller, it's no, it's not Jan Teller, it's
the T2G ones are all filled up, right?
So in this case it would be an excitation, say, from a hole in an x squared minus y squared orbital to a hole in a z squared orbital.
So within the EG
or the other possible orbitals.
Yeah, so that would be Jan Teller then.
Well, I mean it's Jan Teller active, so it could involve a lot of phonon size structure because that's that kind of an excitation could involve a lot of phonon excitations, of course.
You see polarization dependence in these spectra on the previous slide?
Yes, yes. Hill sees polarization dependence for, let me go back. Yeah, so these lower two lines, the black ones, are both for the same compound, lanthanum copper oxide, and for polarization perpendicular to these copper oxide planes, he sees this bump, but for the other polarization, he sees nothing. So we didn't take this into account in our approach. But, sorry?
Doesn't it drop out?
No, not necessarily. So you could say if you use a different polarization, you end up with a different 4p orbital. So the whole situation is a little bit different then, because you have you don't have a 4p z excitation or excited electron, but the 4p orbitals point in your plane. So maybe it couples to 3D of the neighboring atoms, or I don't know. It would require a different approach, I guess.
But the resonance energy is also very different. So
yeah, but I assume
the same energy, or
I don't know if they changed.
The 4P, you know, we know from the band structure that the 4P PZ orbital energies and the PXY orbital energies are very different by about 3 or 4 electron volts is where the onsets.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You should really move the energy also when you change the
position. I assume.
So you're back on resonance, right?
I don't know if you did that, but if you didn't, that would be, of course, an obvious explanation.
Yeah.
You go off resonance and then it's no longer a strong perturbation. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Would have to ask him.
Can I ask, in reality, there is some kind of resonance energy, the well screen, the far screen. So in your formula, how do we think that you tune the pitch and which resonance? Well screen, far screen, how do we think about that in your formula?
Well, you could take it to be the lowest possible state with the lowest possible energy state with a core hole there. I don't recall the exact numbers, but I think for our analysis, it also doesn't really matter what exact number you put in for the resonant energy, as long as it's as it's close to one of the resonances in your system, because if you go a little bit back to here, you see that this resonant prefactor it basically takes care of these intermediate state resonances, as you would say.
So you well describe the well screen state, D10 M bar state in this formula?
I guess that would be in here. So if you tune your incident energy to UC, that's the well screen state, then you would get a resonance enhancement of the amplitude. But basically where we start to count with this detuning is you take the ground state of the valence electrons, and then let's see. Yeah, I think from there you can say that in that background you have the 4p at this specific level. So.
And what is the energy resolution in this resonance? You are discussing something with the gap, but where is the gap? There are a lot of space here.
The energy resolution in this measurement, you mean?
Yeah, energy, yeah.
So that's 100 millielectron volt about. So that's very, very large. Yeah.
But where is the gap?
The gap is here.
So this, it means that this the large peak is too large.
This one?
No.
The elastic peak.
Elastic
was huge.
It's huge. It's very, very wide, yeah? Is it connected with the energy resolution?
Yeah, it's 100 millivolts wide. But it's so high that the half width, you know.
I see.
Right?
Yeah. It's a half width, yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's knocked down to the
half. Yeah. So the zero loss intensity is huge.
Yes.
10 to the fourth.
Okay. Yeah. Right, so we were with the copper oxide layers. So you have holes at the copper sites. These holes carry spin 1/2, and you can model them at low energy with this Heisenberg model, very simple. And well, the ground state is ferromagnetically ordered, of course. And the excitations on that are collective excitations, are the magnons. So now the question is, how do we couple this core hole to magnons? To do that, we go back to the Hubbard model. So here are the copper atoms with one electron in the d x square minus y square orbital. You can do hopping, and this of course gives you the Hubbard u. And if you take the limit of small t over u, you get this Heisenberg model back, with an exchange that is t square over u, basically. Now, at the k edge, so that corresponds to indirect tricks, where you shoot the electron above the Fermi surface. So let's do that. You create a core hole at one of the sites in your system. And now if you do the hopping, then two electrons sit on top of this core hole, and you can model this by locally lowering this penalty u, because they like to sit on the positive core hole, of course. And if you now look at the exchange constant there, which has the u in it, you see that it will change if there's a core hole. So basically what the core hole does is locally changing this super exchange constant. So that's how it couples to magnons, the core hole.
But do you imply that the electrons are faster than the core hole lifetime?
Well, not necessarily, but I mean, there is a certain probability that they do this thing, right?
So T and gamma should be related somehow in this picture.
Yeah, but. Yeah, but if you say that the electrons are too slow, then nothing happens,
yeah.
And you see nothing, of course. But what you see to first orders is exactly this. It does happen, but maybe not so often. Uh, Okay, so we have this local modification of the super exchange constant, and we put it in this intermediate state Hamiltonian, which gives you something like this. So this is to first order in this UCL expansion. And what you see is that you measure a four-spin correlation function, so that's different from neutron scattering, but maybe not so easy to think about. So if you write it in linear spin wave theory, you end up with a two-magnon excitation if you start from the ground state. Now you can see that it should be two-magnon and not one-magnon because the spin is, of course, conserved. And, so if you create one-magnon somewhere, then you have to create another one to conserve your total spin. And you can make a spectrum for this. So what you see here is some path through the Brillouin zone. So this is Q makes this trace. Here you see the energy loss on the vertical axis. And what you see is that the two magnon density of states is very large at the at high energies. But you see that because of matrix element effects, the lower energy tails are more pronounced. Now, if you remember the data from John Hill, you see that at 0, 0 and pi, pi, these wave factors, they measure nothing. And this corresponds to these points in our spectrum. So at least the symmetry of the problem seems to be captured in this model. And the most pronounced peak, they saw that at pi zero, at 500 millielectron volts. So what we basically did is we have our theory curve based on a little bit more extended model than I told you. We also took some longer range exchanges into account and ring exchange on the mean field level. And we do this because there's this paper by Koldea who has done neutron scattering on this compound and found values for all these couplings. So we can use the same model with the same values. And that basically gives us this dashed line. But as we said, the experimental resolution is very bad, about 100 MeV. So that corresponds to approximately 1J. So they wisely left out their horizontal error bars. But if you take that into account, then you get this solid line here.
Did you take the final state effects into account? So, I mean, this the density of states you said was peaked at 4J. But really, for example, in Raman, it shifted down to 3J.
Yeah, so
final state effects. I mean, is there no such thing here?
Is that the same as magnon-magnon interactions?
Yes.
We didn't take them into account. Yeah.
So how does that differ than what we did? Like the work with Dover or Werner, we did a similar calculation where we didn't take account the minimization due to magnon-magnon interactions.
Yeah, but that was off resonance, I think.
That's right.
So that's a big difference.
So this is the same as so basically what you saw in your previous pictures, the color plots that you showed, that's basically a kind of a self-convolution of a two magnon densities of states corresponding to a particular composite Q value, right?
Yes.
So that's why you get these wider structures, but there's still some pretty sharp things there, and that's because of the sharp features in the single magnon densities of states, right?
Sure. But but I wouldn't say that it's really sharp.
Well, it depends on how your color coding is, I guess.
Yeah.
What the amplitude of your color coding is.
Okay, but yeah, it definitely has a peak in the right place, so that makes us very happy.
You put a lot of fancy details into it. I mean, does it make any difference?
No.
But,
no, yeah, the energy resolution is so huge that basically, it's
J
always
dominates
right.
Everything so much, right?
I'm sorry?
J dominates everything.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yes, but
compared to J prime.
Also the ring exchange is very large here, and that renormalizes your J, but also your J prime quite a lot. So the second neighbor coupling.
Yeah.
Okay, I can show you the same for other wave factors.
Is this 2 magnon energy that you then get? Of course, the Raman, the 2 magnon Raman scattering is at Q equals 0.
Yes.
So where would you find the 2 magnon PK? So would this does this correspond? Does this agree with 2 magnon Raman scattering?
Well,
as far as energetics is concerned, of course your intensity is zero at Q
yes.
zero, but they have a large intensity. They have intensity only at Q equals zero.
Yeah. So basically, that means that this technique is complementary to Raman scattering.
Sure. Yeah. Your energetics agrees with.
Well, if you take this magnon-magnon interaction into account, the energy comes down. Yeah. Yeah, so this has been done by two Japanese colleagues, and I think their main find is that it broadens the peak and brings down the intensity, so it smears basically the peak, especially to lower energy tail. Okay, but
so how much difference do you guys find? So they did that calculation also, I think, for including the magnon-magnon interaction.
I think it's similar, isn't it?
I remember it was...
paper with Tom Diverol.
Yeah. I don't remember the exact details, but...
Well, I'm a bit confused because we went back to the Hubble model and we just did the... just expanded in the, I mean, we looked straight into the charge sector, what happened, right? So here I'm confused about what happened in terms of the spins. Because you're going back straight to the spin and infinium for looking at this cross section.
So what we basically do is we take a Heisenberg model and at one site, we change all the exchange constants to neighboring sites.
Right. So we just put the gauge potential in the Hubble model and expanded to second order and kept the Q dependence.
Yeah.
Because you're moving charges, right? So it's easier to see it in the Hubble model than in the spin model.
Yeah, but
there's a bit of a difference here in
the whole approach is different because the resonance is not in
the resonance is not in our
calculation. The core hole has to be in there.
Yeah.
The important thing is the core hole. That gives you the Q dependence of the scattering amplitude. So that's exactly the symmetry you're talking about. It's no longer allowed at gamma and at pi pi.
Yeah.
Has to be close to a cosine ka type of or a sine ka type of relationship.
Okay. Well, we also compared to other wave factors, and you could say as far as the experimental resolution is concerned, this it agrees, but. Of course, it would be nice to have better measurements with better energy resolution to really compare how good it is. It seems very hopeful. So now, the second part for the magnetic rigs is at the L edge. So now we don't excite the core electron too far above the Fermi surface, but directly into the valence band. And of course, you get a completely different coupling to the core hole now. it's kind of interesting because Girangeli and his colleagues are measuring this right now, and I can give you a sneak preview of their measurements. So what they basically see is a dispersive feature similar to what we calculated for the K edge, so for indirect tricks. You have to take into account that the L edge, you shoot a 2p electron to 3d, so that has a lower X-ray energy associated with it. So that means that the momentum transfer is limited to about half the WN zone, something like this. So they only see the inner half around Q is zero, the WN zone. Another thing they see is that right at Q is zero, they see some weight around 3J, and this feature disappears of resonance compared to the first thing they see. So what can we say from our theory with that? Oh, yeah, to remind you, so around Q is zero, they only basically see this dispersive part, and here if you go to the zone corner. Okay, so we go back to the Hubbard model again, and now we don't shoot the core electron completely out of the system, but we place it in the valence band here. So now if you want to do the hopping, so you hop a neighboring electron onto this doubly occupied site, it doesn't work anymore because it's completely occupied. So you can show that this gives an exchange coupling zero between the core hole site and the neighboring sites. So again, with this different mechanism, you have the same result, namely that the super exchange is changed by the core hole very locally. Of course, that's not such an exciting result. We have exactly the same as before. Well, at least that's nice because if you remember the first thing I mentioned that they maybe see is the same feature as we calculated before. So that would be very nice if they do see that. So for us, it's of course more interesting to do a little bit more. You have more intensity at the L edge than at the K edge. So it would make sense to go beyond our ultra-short core hole lifetime approximation. So basically, we want to do the second order in the UCL expansion too. Well, that's this one, and you can calculate this. It again gives a 2 magnon contribution at zero temperature. And if you go on resonance, then this parameter delta is purely real, imaginary, sorry. So it's minus I gamma. And this thing is real. The same here. So there's a phase difference between these two amplitudes of 90 degrees, so they don't interfere.
So what is the order of magnitude difference between these two?
So the order of magnitude is J over delta. So that's 120 milli-electron volts, something like this, over a core hole broadening of 250 milli-electron volts. So at the L edge, that's yeah, so it's a factor of a half. So that's why we hope you can actually see this this thing at the L edge, because the core hole lifetime is not so very short. So that's an interesting test case, if you like. So this is what the second order spectrum looks like. And you can see that at Q is zero, we expect some weight around 3J, 3.5J maybe. So that's very interesting. So what about the third part they see? If you go off resonance, so off resonance, this would be omega detuning. So off resonance, delta is large or larger, which means that this term becomes less important if you compare it to this one. So you would expect this 3J feature to disappear of resonance compared to the first order term. So it would be very nice if they actually see this, but as I said, the measurements are still going on, so definitely be interesting to follow what comes out. How am I doing on time? Okay. So this is last part, orbital rigs. So we also looked at this lanthanum manganite compound. Basically has a cubic structure of these manganese and oxygen octahedron. Well, you all know the material, of course, so you get this crystal field splitting. D2G is in a high spin state, and of course this aligns the EG spin. And basically what you get is an A-type antiferromagnetic order, so you have layers that are ferromagnetically ordered, and they are stacked in an antiferromagnetic way. So if you look at the Kugel Chomsky model now, and you set the Hund's rule coupling constant over U, the Coulomb repulsion, to zero, you get something like this. So the orbital degrees of freedom are only there if the spins are aligned ferromagnetically. Say align antiferromagnetically, and this is -1.4 if you look at it classically, and this thing is zero, so there's no coupling. Well, you can say because of the manganese T2G, the core spins, so to say, are quite large. You can say that the fluctuations on the EG spins are rather small, so these are the EG spins, and then you can say the coupling is at least very small between the layers, and the orbital coupling. I mean, right. So this reduces the whole thing effectively to a two-dimensional orbitally interacting model. So the ground state of this system, then, if you look at one such layer, is alternately occupied EG orbitals. So you could say it's either because of Jahn-Teller distortion or because of this Kugel-Chomsky super exchange model. And, well, the collective excitations are orbitons or orbital waves. So it's very analogous to spin waves. You could say this. If the lower orbital is occupied, you call it spin down. If the upper one is occupied, you call it spin up. And that way you could write the whole orbital Hamiltonian in terms of pseudo spins interacting. Okay. So if you look at this pseudo spin model, what effectively what happens is one spin up to the other side and helps back, and so you get something like a Heisenberg model, but different, because you could have terms like S plus SC, where one pseudo spin changes orbital and the other one doesn't, so there's no conservation of pseudo spin, and that's why you would expect also single orbiton excitations when you do resonant inelastic X-ray scattering on these materials. Right, so that's in contrast to what we found for the magnetic scattering. So then the question, how does the core hole couple to these orbital degrees of freedom? Well, it's the same story again. So we take initial state, excited, X-ray. And now you can see that both are above the core hole. We lower their Coulomb repulsion, and otherwise we enhance it a little bit. So that again gives you a modification of the super exchange coupling between these two sites. Okay, we put that in our expansion again, and to first order you'll find this. So we again have this two orbiton continuum as we had the same as with the magnetic scattering, but you now also have a single orbiton peak. Of course, this one is a very sharp one, and this is smeared out because if you look at one Q vector, then there are only two orbitons that have a definite energy. So you probe the dispersion directly here. You can see that the matrix elements have quite a large effect. So if you look in this picture where you see the total weight, so that's integrated over energy here for a fixed wave factor, you find that the one orbiton spectrum has a huge weight around pi, where the two orbiton thing basically disappears. Of course, if you want to go and measure this is quite hard. So J is something of the order of 25 millielectron volts. If you compare this energy scale then to the current experimental resolution, there's no way that you can resolve this from the elastic peak. But if you want to try and measure it, then I think this part is easiest to measure because it's highest in energy, and you can see here the weight is highest for the two orbiton part.
Excuse me, what is the energy for the one excitation energy for the one orbiton?
What this energy is?
Yeah.
So this peak would be about 2J, so that's 50 millielectron volt, but that's a guess. Nobody actually knows, I think, what J exactly is.
So it's not, I mean, the artillery energy is much larger than this, right? So
yes, so we didn't take this Jantelov stuff into account. We looked at the Kuhl-Chomsky model where the orbital ordering arises from the super exchange interactions. But you're right, if there is this Jantelov effect, will shift up this energy. Yeah.
Because that's something like 0.5 electron volts, 500 milli electron volts.
I don't know.
The estimates range from above that to about 1.5 eV, I think, actually.
Okay. Anyway, it's much larger than this. That's my point.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's all the approximation that just the system to be higher, that's the higher energy.
Okay, well, that concludes my talk. You can read the conclusions yourself, I think. Questions?
I mean, Phil Allen has done some work dealing with orbiton excitations. So how does your work compare with this?
I don't know.
They were probably analyzing Raman, I think.
If you would compare it to Raman scattering, again, you are around Q is zero, so your probe's a completely different part of the Brillouin zone.
I think he, Phil Allen, has the much higher energy scale in his analysis. It's basically the same as a DD excitation, a DD excitation. It's another older terminology that was used many years ago.
So
it has a strong electron quantum coupling.
Yeah.
It's a problem of a couple of local orbital degrees with Antlr photons.
So that's a different than that.
Yes. Starting from that strong coupling thing.
So I suppose also the dispersion could be quite different and could be quite a bit smaller if there is that very strong electron quantum coupling. There it essentially would be a DD polaronic exciton.
Yeah,
or, that's what it would be. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Some Frank quantum.
Yeah, with the Frank quantum shift, but also a narrowing in the dispersion because of the basic mass of the fuzzy particle.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I recall that all these experimentally, all this evidence for orbitons in lanthanum and manganite were very controversial, and
the
jury was that they really couldn't see an orbiton. There was no orbiton there to see, right? I mean, am I correct in saying
but
that?
But these were Raman experiments.
These were Raman experiments, and then, yeah, there were mostly Raman experiments.
Yeah, but there's lots of experimental, or even very old experimental data showing that you have DD excitations that are inside the gap and nickel oxide.
Whether these are orbitons or not, that's another
thing. Well, that's what they're, that it's the terminology, it's just terminology, it's the same thing.
Because
it's exactly the same thing.
From what I understood, the argument for orbitons and yttrium vanadate, or some of these vanadates, were much stronger. I mean, I remember this talks by Guinea Kailuin that he looks at vanadium 3 plus, right? You must know this. It's better than
Okay, but there's the controversy as to whether they're multiphonons or whether they're orbitons.
So the controversy is wherever you go, right? No, I was just thinking if the vanadates are perhaps a better example of doing these calculations on. From what you're telling me, there's no clean system, right?
Well, I think that, for example, one of the first observations of the DD excitons were by Jim Allen, actually, in about 1955 or 60 or something like that, in his PhD thesis, in which he looked at CR203 and very clearly saw the DD excitons. And actually, because of because of the larger Brillouin zone, you have a so-called Davidoff splitting of the DD excitons. And you could clearly see that, and that basically would translate into a dispersion if that doubling of the unit cell or that wasn't there. Okay, so in a sense, he even saw the dispersion, you might say, and it was the dispersion of a DD exciton in ordinary theory is given by basically the super exchange interaction, p squared over u, and that's what he found also. So the orbitons and DD excitations, they're basically the same thing.
So when are they interesting? If they disperse?
I think they're very interesting. I think what's interesting about them is if they have such a very strong coupling to the super exchange interaction. That's when you get possible combined bound states of orbiton excitations to get an orbiton and a magnon, for example, could form bound states. And those are new physics, which is very interesting. So in these Kugel-Komsky cases where if you have orbitals which are perpendicular to each other as far as the orbital orientation is concerned, the exchange interaction is weakly ferromagnetic, whereas if they're pointing towards each other, it's strongly antiferromagnetic. So there you have, in those cases, a very strong coupling to the spin system, and that's basically what they were doing here also, I guess.
So in this calculation, you fix the spin structure to calculate the orbital.
Yes.
Yeah, they fix the spin structure here.
Since the ITP colloquium is at 2, maybe it's a good time to break.